Crying Out to God, Prayer and Praise in the Psalms, the focus of the 73rd Annual Bible Lectureship at Freed Hardeman University.
This is a very loose organization, somewhat more organized than CATS, I would think. there are no membership dues, there's no membership role. It's people that are interested in the restoration movement and want to promote the study of it. We meet four times a year, as Sam said. For programs very similar to this one right here, and we've been very gratified by the response, and especially this morning. I believe this is the largest crowd we have ever had. But we ask you to do one thing, is that four programs a year, we're always looking for speakers. We're looking for someone that has something to say about the restoration movement. And so if you would have any suggestions, put them on paper and hand them to me, Sam, Wayne, Tom, Wayne, and let's see, Scott, that's who I left out, yeah. And we'll be happy to consider that. It's hard to introduce someone that you don't know. And I first met Terry Gardner in person about 30 minutes ago, or an hour and 30 minutes ago, I guess. However, we are acquainted. We've talked on the phone. We've corresponded on email, and it's a real pleasure to have him with us today. He is a practicing attorney, and from what I can find, a very busy one also. He is also a historian. I think I first found out about Terry reading some of the biographical sketches he wrote on the characters of the Restoration Movement. He also, in 2001, produced a full-size copy of Ligon's Portraiture of Preachers. If you've not seen that, that's available at on the Internet. And I don't know if you still got any left for sale.
I don't.
No, they're not. I think his greatest contribution, perhaps, is his part of the biography of Foy E. Wallace, Jr. He and Brother Noble Patterson produced an excellent book. Brother Patterson brought in the... some articles by Wallace, some pictures, advertisements, and so forth, but Terry wrote the biography. And I would, Terry, once again, encourage you to put your part of it in a separate printing as soon as you can. It's an excellent, excellent biography. I believe two questions, perhaps, is his part of the biography of Foy E. Wallace, Jr. He and Brother Noble Patterson produced an excellent book. Brother Patterson brought in the... some articles by Wallace, some pictures, advertisements, and so forth. But Terry wrote the biography. And I would, Terry, once again, encourage you to put your part of it in a separate printing as soon as you can. It's an excellent, excellent biography. I believe two qualifications also. He's an elder in the church. And he's also a very kind man, a very helpful man. I've written him numerous times and said, Terry, what can you tell me about R.E.L. Taylor or W.T. Grant? And just comes back a paragraph on these fellows that nobody's ever heard of. But he's been most cooperative, and for this we really, really appreciate. And I believe also this kindness illustrates that he's a very fine man. I first heard of Austin McGary when I read Search for the Ancient Order the first time, and I've always been fascinated by him, and so I'm happy to present Terry Gardner now talking about Austin McGary.
Sam, can you advise how long should I go?
Yes.
A little.
40
just go 40 minutes. Okay, I can do that. Austin McGary, I think, is one of the most remarkable men in the history of the Restoration Movement, and I think also perhaps one of the least understood. I found this quote from the pen of McGary himself, written in 1903, when he recalled this. He said, as far as I then knew, this is referring to 1884, the year that he begins his newspaper, the Firm Foundation, as far as I then knew or had reason to believe, there were but three men in the wide world who were in sympathy with the cause in which I went. And that cause was his belief that baptism for remission of sins is essential to its validity. Unlike Smith and Jones that we just heard about, Austin McGary is perhaps one of the most influential preachers of the 19th century. And the fact that he's influential at all, to me, is quite a fascinating thing. When you look at his life, you look at his background, you look at the kind of person that he is, you find yourself wondering, you know, why would McGarry really be influential at all? And so what I want to do is spend just a few minutes this morning discussing the early life of McGarry, his time with the Firm Foundation, which composes about 19 years, his publication of the Gospel Outlook, the Dr. Burlington incident, his apology to David Lipscomb, issued in 1923, 5 years after Lipscomb's death, and then just a few very brief concluding comments. I think those of us that have a passion for history, and maybe I should better say obsession for history, we have this desire to correct the wrongs of the past. And we sometimes forget what Solomon says, which is, that which is crooked cannot be made straight. Mark Twain was famous for saying that a lie could go around the world before the truth could get its boots on, and quite often that's the case, and particularly with historical figures. There's a lot of different reasons for that. Sometimes people simply don't have access to the best information. But I want to share a couple things with you from the life of McGarry that have been written, and much of what's been written about the person is not really very, very well understood, and I want to begin with a few quotes. This is from Earl West's book, Search for the Ancient Order. He says, in years to come, after McGarry had settled down to preach the gospel, reports circulated that he'd killed a man. Actually, McGarry, with all his experiences, never killed a single person, although on this occasion, his deputies acting on his orders did shoot an outlaw. So if you know something about McGarry or think you know something about McGarry from Earl's Search for the Ancient Order, that's what you may know. The Firm Foundation published this about McGarry in 1959. He said, McGarry was widely known as the gunless sheriff. His only gun was the double barrel, the Bible, the Old and New Testament. This is from an article by Oscar Henderson, who clearly never knew Austin McGarry. Lane Cubstead, in the Abilene Christian College lecture, said this, he was generally considered to be fair, however, he never killed a man in this job, which sometimes called for it, even though in latter years his reputation as a gospel preacher was tinged a little by rumors about his wicked past. Lane Cubstead, Abilene Christian College lectures. Well, the real question is, what did Austin McGarry say? And this is the first thing he said. When I was in my 23rd year, I had a serious difficulty with two men in Midway, Texas, in which one was killed and the other seriously wounded by pistol shots fired into them by me. Just tinged a little, you know, by rumors of his wicked past. And then he goes on and says this, while I was the sheriff of Madison County, Texas in 1877, it became my official duty to arrest a desperate Negro who was hiding in a swamp. I summoned two men to assist in the arrest, and when we located the fugitive and closed in on him, I demanded his surrender. He said he would surrender, but when I approached to handcuff him, he made a desperate effort to draw his pistol, but was shot dead in the attempt. Well, this is somewhat different from much of what we hear about Austin McGarry, isn't it? And it tells us a little something about his background, but I want to add a little bit to his early life because I think it's important to know and to understand some things about him. His father was a man named Isaac McGarry who immigrated from Ohio to what was then Mexico, later becomes Texas. His father, Isaac McGarry, fights in the Battle of San Jacinto. And one of the things that we know occurs is that Isaac McGarry guards Santa Ana after the battle is over. It is alleged, I don't know that I can completely prove or disprove it, but it's alleged that when the battle was over, he liberated Santa Ana's 10-inch stiletto with handsomely carved yellow bone handles. This knife eventually ended up in the family of J.D. Tant, where it remains to this day. His mother dies when Austin McGarry is 7 years old. If you've read Shrigley's book, and our kind of our first photo of that heroic-looking Austin McGarry comes from Biography and Sermons of F.D. Shrigley. For most of you, it's probably the only photograph you've ever seen of Austin McGarry. But you get some sense of the fact that these are folks that grew up in very difficult, tough frontier times. He loses his mother at age 7. His father never remarries. His father was given a very substantial amount of land as a result of fighting for Texas independence. He received not one but two sections of land, a section of land being 640 acres. In addition to that, Isaac McGarry invested in a number of business ventures, most of which didn't look like they were going to really pay off, but eventually they did. Isaac McGarry goes to Washington, D.C., cashes in warrants worth $20,000, which was just an enormous amount of money for that time. However, in 1866, Austin's father ends up dying. In between all of these events, of course, is the Civil War. And one of the things that you find about Isaac McGarry is that Isaac McGarry is a person of incredible passion. In order to get things done in life, you have to have passion. If you don't have passion, things become ugly very, very quickly. And I think when you look at the life of McGarry and you sometimes wonder, how did this guy get anything done? What you have to recognize is when he believes he's right, he's absolutely fearless, he's courageous, and he's passionate. He's devoted to what he wants to do. And he writes this about the beginning of the Civil War. He said that himself and a gentleman named Norman Kittrell, who later becomes a judge in Texas, at age 16, we marched side by side screaming for secession. Screaming for it. Well, that tells you something about his passion. And, of course, he's not the kind of person to be chanting for secession and not be involved in the Civil War. So, of course, he enlists. He's underage. And within a few weeks, he's kicked out of the Confederate Army. But then he reenlists and serves for a couple of years. Allegedly, he never saw battle action. I've looked at his Civil War records. One sort of wonders whether he saw battle action or not. He's the kind of guy that's involved in trouble and difficulty all of the time. In 1866, he marries for the first time. Now, keep in mind in all of this, he's not a Christian of any sort. At best, he's a skeptic. He's not sure whether there is or there is not a God. So he inherits property from his father. He, along with his sister and half-sister, inherit the father's estate when he dies in 1866. Soon, they're blessed with two children. But almost just as quickly, his first wife dies, and he marries his second wife, whose name is Lucy B. Kittrell. If you read the old issues of the Firm Foundation, you will occasionally find articles signed L. B. McGarry. For a long time, I thought, I didn't know Austin McGarry had a brother. Well, those were articles that were written by his wife, Lucy. She sometimes signed articles as Sarah. She is an incredibly strong, intelligent person. And she is the sister of his good friend, Norman Kittrell, who was a very prominent Texan in his own right. Now, of course, kind of connected with all of this is the difficulty that he has with the Torah boys, one of whom he shoots to death, the other of whom he seriously wounds. McGarry initially takes off. There's no law in Texas. Part of the reason why you know there's no such thing as a gunless sheriff in Texas in the 1870s is any sort of a gunless sheriff is called the dead sheriff. He just doesn't live very long. So McGarry takes off and is on the run for a while, finally comes back to face justice post-bail, and he's acquitted on the grounds of self-defense. And McGarry believes to his dying day that it was self-defense, not that he's proud that he killed the man. He feels terrible about it. He's extremely bothered by it when he writes about these things. In any event, a lot of details. I mean, one of the things about McGarry's life is it's so huge we could spend 4 hours and not really touch the hem of the garment, but we will press on for the sake of time. He does serve as the sheriff of Madison County, Texas for 2 years. He is a highly efficient law enforcement officer. He later recalls that he captured some of the most dangerous outlaws in Texas, and he says nothing about doing it without a gun, by the way. He later transports convicts across the open plains in Texas. There's no railroads. Quite often it's just McGarry and one other guy. And so when you think about that initial picture of McGarry, you're looking at a guy you don't really want to be trifling with. He is genuinely a tough man. Well, his life kind of bounces along until 1881. And he himself describes his life in 1881 as wayward, which is a nice way of saying it. And religiously, he said he was a skeptic. When he began to study the arguments of the Campbell-Owen debate, and while reading the book, McGary Hughes, a gospel preacher named Harry Hamilton, preach a series of sermons at Madisonville, Texas. And he was convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and he's immersed into Christ on Christmas Eve, 1881. And at about the same time, his wife, Lucy B. Kittrell, becomes a Christian. His sister, Fanny, who he's very close to, also becomes a Christian. Well, he's not the bashful, retiring, quiet sort of fella. And once he sees truth and opportunity, he's advancing, and marching on to wherever he's marching on to, sometimes to victory and sometimes to other places. And so he is almost immediately writing articles in the religious press. In 1883, he's been a Christian for less than 2 years, and who's he taking on? David Lipscomb. And after all, why not? He can read the Bible as well as anyone else, and he can understand the truths in the Bible as clearly as anyone else, and so he's taking on David Lipscomb. In 1884, there are at least 10 articles and letters published from the pen of Austin McGary in the Gospel Advocate. And David Lipscomb treats McGary very seriously, something he may have later regretted. Eventually, Lipscomb grows tired of all these articles on what McGary called sect baptism. That's S-E-C-T, sect baptism. McGary's view was very simple, that you couldn't really learn the gospel of Jesus Christ from a Baptist preacher. He just didn't think it was possible. David Lipscomb's view was, look, there are people in the Baptist church who didn't understand at the point that they were immersed that baptism was for the remission of sins. They did it to obey God, but God isn't such a legalist that he would consider that baptism invalid. And so here are the two positions that are going to be cast between the two men for the rest of David Lipscomb's life. When Lipscomb grows tired of printing McGary's articles, it's no problem for Austin McGary. He's simply going to start his own religious newspaper, and that he does. The Firm Foundation begins in September of 1884, and it's essentially pamphlet size. It comes out once a month. This is a bound copy of all of Volume 1 and the first couple of issues of Volume 2. So it wasn't really a particularly large periodical or publication, but it's a voice for McGary. And David Lipscomb, ever the magnanimous David Lipscomb, gives notice to the readers of the Gospel Advocate that McGary's going to begin this publication. And Lipscomb says, look, I wasn't trying to cut Brother McGary off, and if you're interested in what he has to say, subscribe for the Firm Foundation. And so some folks do. One of the things that's remarkable about McGary and his passion is he very quickly gathers around him a cadre of very, very talented men. These are men that include gentlemen like Elijah S. Hansborough, who was an old-time Virginian, had grown up knowing the Lipscomb family, and quickly becomes a key supporter of Austin McGary. And there are other men. John Durst is another one that immediately comes to mind. And, of course, in 1886, one of the key people that accepts the position that McGary advocates is Jefferson David Tant, better known as J.D. Tant, who becomes a great evangelist. You don't think really of Austin McGary as being a great evangelist. He, you know, if you thought about it in biblical terms, he's more like the prophet. He's the one that's carrying the flag, that's out there in the hottest part of the battle, but he's not nearly as effective as somebody like J.D. Tant is as an evangelist. In 1903, looking back on the 19-year history of the Firm Foundation, J.D. Tant sets a couple of things in perspective for us. And this was published by Austin McGary without comment. So I believe that he would have very much agreed with what Tant said. Here were the three major issues that the Firm Foundation deals with from 1884 until 1901. Number one was sect baptism. J.D. Tant noted that often the arguments on this topic generated more heat than light. Tant said more bitterness was engendered on the subject of sect baptism than upon all other subjects besides. McGary believed plainly that a belief that baptism is for remission of sins is essential to its validity. And he argued with force that all who believed that they were saved, as soon as they believed that Jesus was Lord, and then were later baptized to obey and please God, had not obeyed the law of Christ. David Lipscomb, in Tennessee, and Thomas R. Burnett, who was the editor first of the Christian Messenger and later of a paper called Burnett's Budget, are the two main opponents of McGarry's view. And Tant goes on and says, you know, looking back, he said, the firm foundation made three mistakes. He said, first was the bitterness of the battle. Tant noted, we forgot the Savior's instructions to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And when we could not carry the battle by love, we tried to carry it by storm, force, or ridicule. And when we failed to carry, many of us denounced the other fellow as our enemy, as a liar, as dishonest, and tried to arouse prejudice against him. Secondly, Tant noted that we suffered ourselves to be forced to affirm the validity of baptism depends upon the man understanding that baptism is for remission of sins, when we should affirm the validity of baptism depends upon a man having faith in Jesus Christ, and teach that no man can believe in Christ without believing his word. And when a man disbelieves the word of God, like all sectarians do on baptism, he does not believe in God. Third, he said, we soon became judges, and we would decide whether or not the man had been scripturally baptized. And we would call our brethren shakers. The idea being here that if I'd come from the Baptists, I was satisfied with my baptism, even though I'd done it for the purpose of obeying God, they would extend to me the right hand of fellowship, and I would be, what they would say, shaken into the church. So we called them hard names, who did not act as we did in the matter. Instead of wanting the man to satisfy the preacher or himself, we need to teach him that he needs to satisfy God. So here is, kind of in a nutshell, the leading issue that the firm foundation deals with. Now, the other major issues had to do with the use of instrumental music and missionary societies. And, of course, there were a large number of minor issues, which included the formal confession, and some of these may sound strange to our ears, soul sleeping, the future kingdom, Sunday schools, the one-class system, Sunday school literature, voting, joining secret lodges, so on and so forth. Well, things went along in McGarry's life fairly successfully until two events happened, in my opinion. The first thing is Elijah Hansborough, who is this very substantial older man that McGarry respects, dies in 1896. The second thing that happens is his wife Lucy dies in 1897. These were people who I think were a restraining influence on McGarry as much as it was ever possible to restrain Austin McGarry. And he then starts to go in some sort of strange ways and paths. One of the things that happens is he's forced to surrender editorial control of the firm foundation. This happens in 1902. And what had taken place was that McGarry's good friend, J.W. Jackson, he had given the paper only retaining the editorial rights. Well, Jackson died in 1901, and the next thing you know, a man named G.J. Steck owns the paper. Now, Steck had for years been McGarry's bookkeeper. And this was not a person that McGarry really held in very high regard. Steck is trying to build a business. He's a businessman. And McGarry excoriating folks, as only McGarry could excoriate them, wasn't good for business. So he's trying to control Austin McGarry. Well, that's a hopeless task. So in 1902, Steck buys McGarry out. McGarry feels forced out. He's not happy about being forced out. And when McGarry's not happy, it's not long before pretty much everyone knows. This is McGarry and his first wife, second wife, Lucy Kittrell. And here is the front page of the Gospel Outlook. And what's highlighted is this information about McGarry saying, when I started, I only knew of three men who believed as I believed. Well, the Gospel Outlook has this explosive beginning. He's just as mad as he can be at the folks running the firm foundation. And again, this would probably be its own 40-minute talk, just to talk about all the things that happen in the Gospel Outlook. But to say that he waxes very, very hot on a lot of topics is to put it mildly. During this time, he does some moving around. He moves, for example, from Austin, Texas, first to Los Angeles, California, and then he goes on to Oregon. And while all this is going on, one of his former associates, a man named C.E. Holt, has taken a medication that McGarry had sold through the pages of the firm foundation called the Burlington Treatment. This is an advertisement that appeared in the Firm Foundation October 15, 1901. And the owner and proprietor of the treatment was Austin McGarry. Well, C.E. Holt, who again had been a staff writer for the Firm Foundation under McGarry, almost all of McGarry's troubles come from, you know, folks that had worked with him and labored with him. And when McGarry began the Firm Foundation in Volume 1, he had said this: "The Firm Foundation is not in the market at any price as a playground for humbug advertisements to revel in." In 1884, McGarry believed that to run circular advertisements in the Firm Foundation was to attempt to serve God and mammon. Well, by 1900, McGarry's completely reversed field, and part of the problem is it's extremely expensive to run a religious newspaper, and they're all running these humbug advertisements, with the exception of Daniel Sommer, who will never allows them in. The Gospel Advocate runs one humbug advertisement after another, as does the Christian Leader, and on and on. Well, McGarry, being McGarry, decides to cut out the middleman, and so he invents the Burlington treatment. And, of course, the public is led to believe there really is a Dr. Burlington, and so C.E. Holt takes the Burlington treatment, and he has it analyzed, and it turns out that it's tar water, which is not very efficacious on the one hand, but it's not going to kill you on the other hand. A lot of the other medications that papers sold, by the way, contain cocaine, codeine, morphine, all kinds of things. Well, Holt then places an advertisement in the Gospel Advocate and some other papers saying he would pay $25 for the advertisement of Dr. J.H.D. Burlington. Well, this is, of course, offensive to McGarry's friends, and one of them writes in and gives them an address of Dr. Burlington down in Mexico. And Holt sends a certified letter down to Mexico, but the letter's returned, unopened. There's also a little booklet that comes with the Burlington treatment, I should add, and the little booklet tells you things like you should get plenty of sleep if you want to live a long life, a little exercise would be a good thing, some things like this that are included in the Burlington treatment. By the way, the Burlington treatment would cure, it didn't really matter what you had. If you were worried about smallpox, this could prevent it. If you were losing your hair, as some of us are, no problem. You could put the Burlington treatment on. It would regrow. I mean, it was fabulous. And yet it turns out to be tar water. Well, by 1905, McGarry finally concedes there is no such person as Dr. Burlington, and that, in fact, he is Dr. Burlington. This, of course, creates quite a scandal, and McGarry's great foe, Thomas R. Burnett, has a little bit of fun with this at McGarry's expense. First, he lists the Holt advertisement. "I will pay $25 for the post office address of Dr. Burlington." And then T.R. Burnett wrote this: "Attend ye muses, bards give ear, prepare to shed a bitter tear for what befell our state and nation and readers of the Firm Foundation. We had a great and wondrous cure, a remedy so quick and sure that all the ills our flesh had in it would succumb to it in a minute. If some poor man had lost his crop and was all bare and slick on top, you could relieve the naked brother, just rub it on and bring another. The man whose joints were sore and stiff, we could relieve him in a jiff. Or wife's lame back from too much scrubbing, just put it on and keep a rubbing. In one bad case, I heard it said, it very nearly raised the dead." "And when his cash was out of socket, it cured a preacher's empty pocket." Well, that was kind of the end of Austin McGarry for a little while. His health is not good by 1905. He's living in Oregon. He's not happy in Oregon. He had hoped that family members and associates would follow him to Oregon, with kind of a promised land. Nobody comes. And so in 1905, he goes back to Texas, and eventually he goes to Springdale, Arkansas, spends a year in Springdale, Arkansas, but he really ceases to write very much for the religious press. Kind of a furlough, one might say. In 1912, though, he does edit a secular paper called Hammer and Tongs. And this was a paper where McGarry could express his views regarding statewide prohibition. And it might surprise you to learn that McGeary was not in favor of prohibition. Not because he was in favor of alcohol, but this is what he wrote. He said, when statewide prohibition is tried against liquor. Now remember, this is a man that's been a sheriff. This is not somebody that's a hothouse plant or doesn't know what real life's all about. When statewide prohibition is tried against liquor, those who have the liquor thirst and the money to pay for the liquor will get it if the bootlegger has to get down on his knees and let them swig it out of his boots. McGeary concluded his thoughts on prohibition by writing, I now say, though I believe that statewide prohibition is contrary in its methods to the will of God and will work evil in the land, so far as I am concerned, I say, let the people of Texas have prohibition, and I shall not again raise my voice against them. Let them try out their own wisdom. Well, that's 1912. In 1913, he re-enters kind of the religious fray. So he's really kind of been in the wilderness for 6 or 7 years following the Dr. Burlington fiasco. But there was a paper called The Eye-Opener, published in Texas by a man named W.D. Ingram. And Ingram moves The Eye-Opener to Houston, which is where McGeary was then living. And the name of the paper is changed to The Faithful Witness. And in classic McGeary style, he starts off by saying this in his first editorial in The Faithful Witness. He says, I have heard that some of my brethren in the Lord are still nursing the unkind feelings toward me that were engendered years ago during those fiery trials through which I passed while publishing the Gospel Outlook. And that some of these unforgiving brethren have expressed their opinion that my reenlistment in editorial service for the cause of Christ will stir up the smoldering embers and rekindle the hot fires of those turbulent times. I have also heard that one of these brethren said, I've been down and out so long I should just stay out. But conceding for the sake of argument that I have been down and out, it does not savor the Spirit of Christ for one who professes to be imbued with the Spirit of Christ to cry out against a brother whom he considers down and out for making an effort to get up and come back into the good fight of faith. And so McGeary comes back. McGeary notes that he regrets all of his past mistakes. One of the things about McGeary that's almost unique is he's constantly acknowledging his mistakes. Now, his critics would say that's because he made so many of them. But the fact of the matter is, every human being makes mistakes. Most of us have a lot of trouble acknowledging those mistakes. Well, the paper fails in fairly quick order. But in 1914, McGeary then starts his own paper, which is called The Open Arena. This paper is a monthly, runs for a couple of 3 years, and in it, McGeary, is basically on the same list of things that he has discussed over the years, including baptism and things of this sort. But one thing that is a little unusual about it is he has a son named Marion who is a socialist, and he prints articles from his son Marion about socialism. And McGeary himself says, I think socialism is one of the best systems devised by men. But he said, the people that are running the Socialist Party are so corrupt that I could never be a socialist because of that situation. McGeary also writes a lot for the secular press. I mean, he is this unique Texas character. He has a following throughout the state of Texas, and especially in the city of Houston. And he's constantly writing for the secular press. There's an article that he writes in the Houston Chronicle on the Ku Klux Klan. And a lady writes in and wants to know why he won't support the Ku Klux Klan. And McGeary says this in part. He said, the Bible teaches in many places in various ways that even God himself hates sin. McGeary had said he hated the Klan. And his critic was like, how can you hate the Klan? Don't you know people that are in the Klan? McGeary goes, yes. I know people in the Klan. I have relatives in the Klan. Some of my best friends are in the Klan. But then he says, the Bible teaches in many places in various ways that even God himself hates sin. And the inspired psalmist says, I hate all false ways. The ways of the Klan are false ways. False to Christ and Christianity. False to our nation and its Constitution and Bill of Rights. False to our state and its Constitution and laws. And false to every principle of justice, right, morality, democracy, and civilization. As David said, through the precepts I get understanding, and therefore I hate all false ways. So I say, through the precepts of the Bible and the Constitution and laws of our nation and state, that I get understanding concerning Christianity, morality, democracy, and Americanism. Therefore, I hate the false ways of the devil and the Ku Klux Klan." This is 1920 in Houston, Texas. You could get killed for saying a lot less, and he's saying this through the Houston Chronicle. And in his preamble to this, part of what he says is, I'm going to tell you, he tells his inquirer, "Let me tell you in advance that I'm going to tell you exactly what I think, no matter what happens to me on this topic." Well, when he's right, he's really, really right. When he's wrong, nobody can be more wrong than McGarry. And yet McGarry keeps at his post all of the time. One of the things that I wrote an article about in the Gospel Advocate 3 or 4 years ago was a little piece called "Lipscomb, McGarry, and Forgiveness." And I want to kind of finish my comments on McGarry with this piece. And if we have time for a question or two, we can entertain those at that time. In the Gospel Advocate, this is May 31st, 1923. Now, this is the paper that McGarry's opposed all of his life. McGarry apologized for the harsh things that he had said about David Lipscomb in the Gospel Outlook in 1905. And by the way, you know, he called Lipscomb every name in the book. A double-dealing, Janus-faced, toad-truckling. I mean, he spared. The man could use adjectives, I will just tell you that. This is what he writes, though, in the Gospel Advocate in 1923. "I confess that years ago I wrote some things about the Advocate and its editors that I should not have written. And I may inadvertently..." Oh, I'm sorry, I got to drop down. "Brother H. Leo Bowles and Brother J.C. McQuitty have both written me concerning some very improper and unchristian-like things that I said about Brother David Lipscomb in the Gospel Outlook many years ago. I sincerely and deeply and penitently regret having said these things, and I unfeignedly and feelingly beg all of Brother Lipscomb's personal friends and the Brotherhood in general to forgive me. It will be a lifelong regret with me that I did not apologize to Brother Lipscomb before he died for saying these things about him." And that was in the Gospel Advocate, 1923. Well, one of Brother Lipscomb's personal friends was M.C. Kerfees. Kerfees called it one of the finest apologies that he'd ever read. And McGarry then spends the last 5 years of his life writing for the Gospel Advocate, of all papers, and sometimes dealing with sect baptism. Well, he dies in 1928. He was 82 years old. And I'll share just a couple of comments that were made about him. J.D. Tant wrote of McGarry, "His heart was as tender as a child's. When he saw his wrong, he would confess his wrong and turn from it. Of all the men I was ever intimately associated with, I think McGarry was the greatest teacher and strongest writer we ever had in Texas. And he did more to hold down departures than any other man." F.B. Shrigley wrote of McGarry that he was a brilliant writer and a worthy foe for any man in discussion. And Shrigley added, "I would not say that he was free from faults, but he showed a forgiving spirit. And if I am so fortunate as to enter into that glad city, I shall expect to see my brother and friend, A. McGarry." And then one concluding one that I think is particularly apropos, given who I'm being followed by. This is from the Gospel Advocate of 1923 by John T. Smithson. He says of McGarry, "He was not afraid to take a position, and when he took a position, he did not lack for courage to defend it. It takes courage for a man to stand for truth and righteousness in these evil days." Well, we've touched the hem of the garment, I'm afraid, but hopefully it gives you a little bit of an idea about a man who was a man of passion, who did some great things, who, when he dealt with the truth, nobody could be better or stronger. At times, also had feet of clay. Thank you very much.
This presentation is brought to you by Fried Hardeman University and is shared using a Creative Commons license, meaning some rights are reserved. For more, visit fhu.edu/lectureship.